from the ACLU. This is At Liberty. I'm Vanessa Handy, a producer for the show and your host for this episode. And I want to start this episode in verse.
A school bus is a microphone, a beat machine, a recording booth. A school bus is a horn section, a rhythm section, an orchestra pit, a balcony to shoot paper ball three-pointers from. A school bus is a basketball court, a football stadium, a soccer field, sometimes a boxing ring. A school bus is a movie set, actors, directors, producers, script, scenes, settings, motivations, action, cut. Your fake tears look real. These are real tears, but I thought we were making a comedy. A school bus is a misunderstanding. A school bus is a masterpiece that everyone pretends to understand. A school bus is the mountain range behind Mona Lisa, the Sphinx's nose, an unknown wonder of the world, an unknown wonder to Canton Post, who heard bus riders talk about their journeys to and from school. But to Canton, a school bus is also a cannonball, a thing that almost destroyed him, almost made him motherless.
That's writer Jason Reynolds, reading from his book, Look Both Ways, A Tale Told in 10 Blocks. You'll find moments like this in many of his books, capturing the world of a kid, making their realities come alive on the page through poetics, all before revealing a hard truth about his characters and their experiences. Though he writes for young audiences, he doesn't shy away from serious themes or challenges, with many of his books dealing with death, mourning, racism, police brutality, and gun violence. Jason writes the stuff of real life, and this has made him a superstar among young readers and adults like me. He has penned numerous best-selling and award-winning books like the one you just heard from, and others like Ghost, As Brave as You, Long Way Down, and All American Boys with Brendan Keeley. He also used his gifts to promote literacy as the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature from 2020 to 2022. And today, he joins me to talk about carrying on the tradition of Black storytelling and how we can all inspire young people to love literature. Jason, welcome to At Liberty, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to get to chat with you and give our audience the absolute pleasure of getting to know you perhaps a bit better. In the excerpt from Look Both Ways that we heard from you, you wax lyrical about all that a school bus can be. And in that book, you offer almost vignettes that capture what goes on after the school bell rings. And in reading that and reading many of your other works, I've noticed that childhood is the backdrop of a lot of your books. And so I want to start our conversation there, specifically in your 10th year of life. And that's because in a previous interview, you've described that year as, quote, the best and the worst year of your life. And you said that in all of your books, this is the year that you're pulling from. So I want to dig into that. If you could take us back to Oxon Hill, Maryland, and explain some of what went on during that 10th year and how this part of your past resonates so profoundly in your present work.
I mean, everything was going on. You know, I think, gosh, 10-year-old Oxon Hill, I think, well, first let me say, I grew up in this house that was, it was cool. I had, you know, aunties and cousins and my siblings and my mother and father. And my parents were these kinds of people who were who demonstrated love in an interesting way. And they were very much so the type of parents where you knew they liked each other and you knew that they had fun together. But when you're a child, you don't see what lies beneath, right? You don't see some of the conversations that were happening or the issues that they were having. And because I couldn't see it when my parents split up, it was devastating in a different way because it seemed to come out of nowhere. And then my father being like, I'm leaving, right? It's like, my superhero had taken off his cape. I didn't understand the dynamics of separation, how one person has to leave, but it doesn't mean that they're the bad person, but they are the person who is doing the leaving. And so for a child, you resent the leaver, right? And so this began an issue, a fissure, so to speak, in the relationship between my father and I. watching my mother cry was interesting, and seeing her navigate heartbreak. And then on top of all that, because my father left, my mom was like, well, I'm not sending you to the neighborhood schools because there's no man in the house. And I feel like we need to make sure that somebody's going to be here to help you navigate the neighborhood schools, which were not good schools. So my mom was like, well, I'm going to send you to Catholic school. This is a terrible thing to tell me. I'm a public school neighborhood kid. I'm with my friends. I'm in the mischief. What do you mean you're going to send me to Catholic school? I got to put on a uniform. Like, all these things are just completely devastating to me. And then to top all of that off, my grandmother passes away. Now, why do I say this is the best and worst year of my life? Well, it was the worst year of my life just because my family, as I had known it, had changed forever. But what also happens this year is I figure out that rap music is poetry. So in order for me to cope with all the things that were happening around me, I fell in love with hip hop and I fell in love with lyrics. And I wanted to figure out how to use language in the way that they were using language. I didn't want to rap. I just wanted to use the language. And that was sort of the beginning of my relationship with poetry, which I would need because of all the other things that were happening in my life.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's something that I hear so commonly is how in the midst of hardship, so many people turn to rap specifically, but music overall. And I'm so glad you went here because this is exactly where I wanted to go next. This is the year that you just said you really start engaging with rap lyrics and rap as poetry and language as kind of this vehicle. And you also start writing a lot at this point in your life, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wanted to know, one, I'm just so curious about what music you were bumping back then, kind of like what was on the Jason Reynolds 10-year-old soundtrack, but also what rap offered you back then and what you learned from it about storytelling.
You know, it's interesting. It's so funny because I never tell the whole part of that story. So like, because I'm usually talking to teenagers, right? I tell that bit of the story, but it wasn't just rap music. Rap music was a huge part of it, but my father was a music man. And so when we would sit in a chair to get our hair cut, my older brother and I, my father would cut our hair. He was a terrible barber, by the way, a terrible barber, which means I also had to deal with that in the neighborhood, right? Black boys in a haircut is a real thing. And to navigate that was a whole other gauntlet of my life. But when my father would be cutting our heads, he would play his music, and he was into I think I heard the Tracy Chapman album 5 million times, you know, listening to Fast Car or listening to Talking About a Revolution or listening to the acapella song. Like last night I heard the screaming loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me won't do no good to call the police. Right. It's a beautiful poem that she's singing about domestic violence, and to hear that. And to understand what she was doing was just as important. Then my father introduced us to Nirvana. And I'm learning that language doesn't always even have to make sense. You can see what happens when I put this sort of, this chemical with this chemical, right? So all of these things were happening. And I was listening to a little bit of everything. But even as a child, I was carrying all of this language, all this rhythm and music and rhyme and poetry with me everywhere I went.
Thank you for sharing that. And I feel like you painted such a beautiful scene of what your house was like and what your parents exposed you to. And I think that the way that you talk about how poetry and music are connected is something that I think is so present across all genres of music, but specifically the genres of music that I think Black people have either invented or shaped, such as rap and jazz and blues and rock and roll and R&B and soul. All of these genres, I think, are so indicative of how storytelling is embedded in our culture. Like, historically, the stories that we pass down in our community so often have a distinct purpose. They might be warnings or adages or just like things we need to know for literal survival a lot of the time. And I'm wondering what you make of that culture and tradition of Black storytelling and how, if at all, you see your work in continuum of this legacy.
Of course, of course. It's such a good question. I don't think anyone's ever asked this question. It's such a wonderful question. Good on you. What an astute question. Yeah, I think it's, I hope that it's in tradition, right? My goal is that it's in tradition. Look, here's the thing. All the music that you name, we made those musics, right? Along with country music, by the by, right? Which all of which is birthed out of the blues, right? This is all American classical music, specifically Black American classical music, which is American classical music. You know what I mean? You're welcome, America, right? Like and the rest of the world. I'd like to think I'm in tradition with rap music and the freedom of expression and the utter creativity and the bold and rebellious nature of that music, which is also rooted in the rebellious nature of the blues. I'd like to believe that I have the avant-garde nature of the jazz artists throughout the canon of jazz music, whether it be a guy like Scott Joplin who is playing standards, or whether it be someone like Dizzy Gillespie and Miles Davis or Bird, these cats who are playing bebop, a music that was coded in our experiences so much so that it was impossible for anyone else to crack said code. But we understood what it was and we understood the genius of it and the difficulty, right? The sheer skill that it took to make something that brilliant and the ability to hear it in the way it needed to be heard in order for the brilliance to be recognized. Whether I'm writing for children or adults, I think all of us, I'd like to believe that I am working in that space to make something that is on that continuum. I think it's a heavy burden to bear. I think it's a lot of weight. I think that we're lucky if we come even close to the mark.
Yeah. And I would also like to believe that I'm in that continuum, and I'd like to believe that you are too. And it's so true what you said about it being this responsibility and almost burden that we shoulder, because I think we're all in this collective where we're trying to honor those who came before us and the way that their influences are a natural part of our practice. And that shows up in your writing. And I think that it's so nice that those traditions are now something that a young audience gets to be privy to. Some people who might not be as familiar with your story might be surprised to hear all this and learn that you did not read a full book that is cover to cover until age 17. But I think that when you have a moment where you find that book, and for you, I know it was Richard Wright's Black Boy, which is a book from 1945, when you have that moment where you come across not just literature, but art in general that makes you feel very seen or truly changes you, I think that that's a moment one never forgets. And I think it's so nice that your books now are serving that purpose for kids today. And I want to know how you respond to that, this notion that your work is now filling gaps for students and educators and really impacting people's relationships with literature.
I mean, look, I think, first let me say this. I mean, one of my biggest missions was to try to figure out how to create a literary archive of the lives of young people living today as they're living them. So that one day, when they're 40, they can look back and say, you know, if you want to know what it was like to be 16 in 2024, read these books. If you want to know what it was like to be, you know, 10 in the 2010s, here's a whole bunch of books by Jason Reynolds that document our lives, right? There's actual documentation through the literature of what our life was like. I don't have that documentation for me. There are no books I could give anybody that were contemporary literature written for me about the time in which I was going through my adolescence. I was living through the 90s, and it's like I'm literally listening to Biggie right now, right? Like, I got my headphones on and I'm waiting for somebody to reference them. I got on Jordans. Is anyone ever going to mention the fact that Michael Jordan is the greatest basketball player in the world and I'm idolizing this man and he's not mentioned in a single book of my youth when we were all obsessed with him, or Michael Jackson for that matter?
Yeah.
Right? So the way I think about it is just me trying to make sure that they have a concordance.
Yeah, I get that. And I think cultural specificity is so useful. And it also makes the work come alive. And I think that that is what makes your writing, in my opinion at least, resonate with people of all ages. And I want to talk about your writing a little bit more in depth in terms of your techniques and the elements of style. But in order for our audience to get a taste of that, I would love it if you could read an excerpt from your book, Long Way Down.
I felt like crying, which felt like another person trapped behind my face, tiny fists punching the backs of my eyes, feet kicking my throat at the spot where the swallow starts. Stay put, I whispered to him. Stay strong, I whispered to me, because crying is against the rules. The rules. Number one, crying. Don't. No matter what, don't. Number two, snitching. Don't. No matter what, don't. Number three, revenge. If someone you love gets killed, find the person who killed them and kill them. The invention of the rules ain't come from my brother, his friends, my dad, my uncle, the guys outside, the hustlers and shooters, and definitely not from me. Another thing about the rules, they weren't meant to be broken. They were meant for the broken to follow.
So Long Way Down is deeply personal, and it's also written in verse, as we just heard you read. I'll add a little bit of context for folks about this book briefly. So Will Holloman is the main character of this book. And in the story, his brother Sean was murdered in a shooting. And Will has decided to sort of avenge his brother by shooting the person who shot him. And this book follows him throughout his elevator journey from his building, from his apartment, down to the lobby on his way to carry out the shooting. And it's on this long way down that people from his past who have died, like his uncle and father and brother, appear to him in the elevator and confront him and have conversation with him. And we've touched on it a bit throughout this conversation thus far, but I have already gotten the sense that poetry is so valuable to you, and poetry is everywhere, especially in your writing. In this book, but also in some of your other titles, what do you think poetry provides that perhaps a traditional narrative style does not? Like, why do you opt for verse in some scenarios?
Well, I mean, it just depends. Every story needs what the story needs. First, let me say this. I think poetry is all the writing forms, right? Like James Brown always said, every instrument is a drum, right? I believe that all writing is poetry. It's just about, the form or the format in which that poetry sort of shows itself, right? Like to me, all of my novels are poetry. Now, in terms of writing in the specific poetic form, like Long Way Down, where it's written in verse specifically, you know, I think sometimes the page has to be more like canvas and the words have to be more like paint. And I have to be able to put the words where they belong on the page without thinking about the structure of a sentence, without thinking about the structure of a paragraph, right? An indentation, right? I'm thinking about, enjambment, which is just a word, fancy word for line break, right? I'm thinking about enjambment in specific ways, but in very different ways than I think about paragraphs, right? And so in a story like Long Way Down, which requires a fast pace, which requires tension and stress, it calls for a bit of a haunting. And I think all of those things can happen through language from the subconscious level if you know how to manipulate the language and put the language where it belongs on the page. So for me, the way I think about all of it is just, what does the story need to wrap the reader? What does the story need to make sure that the reader is enraptured and does not want to pull away, does not want to close the book? How do I tap into the reader's empathy, right? The human bits of this reader to say, this is actually a book. We're experiencing this thing together. You are now a part of this conversation. You are now a part of this experience, right? It isn't just reading. It's you're using all of your mental faculties to exist in this world. And I built it that way with that intention. That's all.
Yeah. That's all. As if you didn't just give us allusions and new terms in Jambin. I was not familiar, and now I have a new term to take with me. But that's all. I want to talk about this bit that you just ended on about like the human condition and bringing humanity into your writing, because something that I appreciated in the book Long Way Down specifically, but also overall, was that it didn't really lean into the binary trope of a heroes versus villains story. And I found that the characters instead were very complex and also vexed by these complicated moral challenges. I mean, this book specifically contends with the question of revenge and whether or not to seek it, which I was really captivated by because I think revenge is quite complicated as a concept, in that as a society, we are constantly trying to decide whether or not it's permissible in so many aspects of our lives. I wanted to know what kind of moral questions you were considering when writing this book and how you played with using revenge as an element to drive plot.
This is another very good question. I don't know if I've ever thought of it as a moral. I'm scared of morality, right? I'm scared of writing morality just because who am I? I'm a person living in the world, struggling with morality in and of myself, just because I'm alive in the world. But I think for this book in particular, I'll tell you what I really was trying to sort of excavate is this idea that children are not gangsters and they're not monsters. They're not thugs. They're not hoodlums. They're children. And if we call them those names, we don't have to see them as children, right? Will is not a killer. He's a scared child who feels the weight of his community, the weight of grief from his brother's death, the weight of the rules that have been passed down generation after generation after generation. And he's haunted by that weight. You know, Will is a person who plays around with literacy for fun, right? Who understands how what words can do and what letters can do and how they alchemize simply by the way in which we choose to arrange them, in the same way that our lives alchemize simply by the way they're arranged, right? I am a different thing depending upon the arrangement of my life, you know? And it also just talks about how strange it is that we expect so much. We expect our young people to be able to solve these problems with skills that we've never actually equipped them with. But we blame them for it, when really the blame should be on all of us who have, some of us have done our best, but others of us who have not. Really, we should be talking about the politics of our community. And so I don't know if I answer your question about morality, but it is about humanity and how we all are tied in some strange knot that we spend our entire lives trying to get ourselves out of, only to make more knots. And that is the human condition. It doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It just means it's a thing. Right. It's the conundrum in which we all live. We have all of this stuff that we have to contend with and yet are expected to follow a single through line of morality, which seems a little bit perverse when you think about it this way. I'm just doing the best I can. I'm just doing the best I can. And my characters, all of them, are just doing the best they can.
That's a nice way to put it. I think no matter what age you are, we're all contending with some version of kind of the same stuff. That's what makes life real. And I think that's what makes writing and any piece of work feel real, when it captures those things, those nuances, and those kind of gray areas that we have within ourselves. I want to continue this thread of talking about just real life and representing real life in writing, and pivot to one of your other books, All American Boys, which you co-wrote with Brandon Keeley. And what struck me by that story was just how much of my own experience was reflected in it. For people that are not familiar with the book, it follows how an instance of police brutality shakes up a town and really deeply impacts the lives of two high school boys, Rashad, who is Black, and Quinn, who is white. And when I read this book, I was instantly reminded of the conversations on race that happened while I was a teenager, and the way that you depicted just the ecosystem of a high school, the way that information and drama spreads and the tense nature of classroom conversations on race, and even just kind of the desperation that you feel as, or that one can feel as a young Black person witnessing violence impact your community, particularly police violence, and then seeing the way people try to justify that back to you. That all felt so realistic. And I wanted to know how you and Brandon Keeley worked together to take into account your lived experiences and make it reflective of the way younger people talk about race.
Mm, that's interesting. I don't think so. I think it's weird the way that story was written. And it happened over the course of like a month. It happened so fast. I remember when we made it, we were both like, we made it in secrecy because we knew that our agents and we were afraid that our agents and our editors and everybody would say no, that they wouldn't publish it. It was sort of like, no one wants to touch the topic, you know? And so we made it and we turned it in and let it roll. I remember though, there were a few things we wanted to make sure we addressed, and not addressed because we weren't writing an essay, but we just want to be mindful of. And I think number one, we didn't want, obviously, for Quinn to save the day, right? We didn't want any white savior tropes. The other thing, though, was I didn't want him to seem like a revolutionary, because I don't think that it's fair that I have to live a revolutionary life, right? Whether I do or not is neither here nor there. I don't think it's fair that once I've been brutalized, or once I've been harmed, once I've been victimized, once I've been sort of, you know, spat upon, that I'm then expected to take up arms and take to the street. I'm expected to speak to Congress and get on the news and so forth and so on. And I'm expected to want and to have the capacity to do these things. And the truth of the matter is that I really just want to get well and move on. Right? I really just want to go back to my life, but I'm not allowed to anymore because my name has been turned into a hashtag, and that hashtag has been turned into a symbol, and that symbol has been attached to a movement that I never asked for. And I think we never consider those things. And I wanted to humanize him in a different way than we often see on television when this happens in our communities.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a perspective that I don't see highlighted as much. And you're right in the way that when situations like this happen, we place this responsibility and this air of like martyrdom on impacted people. And it's interesting. Thank you for delving into this and delving into also the conditions in which you created that book, All American Boys. And it's so interesting to hear the way that you kind of moved in silence and in secret, and hearing you talk about that, and also the way we broach these types of subjects with young people, I can't help but think about the situation we have been in politically for the past several years with, you know, this narrative being pushed by those who impose things like book bans or the attack on critical race theory and DEI efforts, all of that. This narrative that the topics you write about are too mature, or they're inappropriate, or it's not the right time, or it's too fraught. How do you respond to these things? Is it just you got to keep doing you and move in silence, or how do you push back? What do you do in those scenarios?
I mean, you definitely make your work, right? I'll say this. It hurts my feelings to know that people think that I'm harming children, right? Like that never feels good because I've dedicated my life to them.
Right. And are arguably, might I say, doing more for young people than probably the people who are saying these things.
Perhaps, right? Perhaps. But I how do I feel about it? I feel sorry for them. Truly. I really do. And that isn't me being flippant or coy. I truly feel sorry for them. I feel sorry for the fact that these people aren't willing to engage in complicated discussions with their young people, right? Aren't willing to humble themselves enough to say, I honestly don't know the answer to the question and I don't understand it. Let's read the book together and figure out where we lie. I feel sorry for people who aren't willing to jump into the intellectual sandbox and wrestle around a little bit, which is all it's meant to be, right? I don't think, my job isn't to tell anybody what to think. Anybody. My job is to only catalyze thought. I mean, right now I got a book coming out in a couple of months about sex. And I'm excited about it because I think, because teenagers have sex. I don't understand what, like, that's all. Like, I don't, because it's a natural and healthy part of our lives that everyone is terrified to talk about in a healthy way, right? And in an honest way. And I'm sure I'll go through this all over again, right? But in my heart and in my mind, I'm like, but how, once again, I come back to Long Way Down, but how do we expect them to know how to manage and navigate this part of their lives? I don't understand how you could shoot a child's curiosity and expect the child to change a world that they weren't allowed to imagine because you wouldn't give them a glimpse into the possibility of what was coming.
And that's... Is that not the whole point of childhood also? I mean, at the ACLU, I think we are just as disenchanted, disheartened, confused as you with the way that people who support book bans and censorship are going about it, because it's as you said, like, why stifle kids from having an understanding and having open dialogue about these things? It's just, yeah. I could say so
weird.
Much, but it makes
so weird.
Not even a modicum of sense. And I love what you said about inspiring kids to be curious. And I think I want to end our conversation there. What does it look like for you to foster a love and curiosity of not just reading, but the world for kids?
You know, I think first I'd say it's been an honor to be one of many people who get to hopefully continue to stoke the fire of imagination and curiosity in young people, right? Like, there are, shout out to the teachers, the parents, the educators, the librarians, shout out to the coaches and the counselors and all these people who work very hard to, you know, to keep the wings of our children clean. I think, you know, for me, I think there's so much value, first and foremost, and honoring who they already are. We spend so much time projecting them into the future. We spend so much time asking them what they will be when they get older. You know, who do you want to be? And really, the question should be, who and what do you want to be now, today, right now, right? I think we as adults have to engage and embarrass ourselves a little more often. I think adults get pretty persnickety. We don't like to be laughed at. But if you're going to be around children, you have to put yourself in positions to be laughed at. Because then what it does is it shifts the power, right? And it'll keep them inspired. You know, sometimes we got to shift the pedagogy. It has to be a reciprocal pedagogy. And it has to be one where we come down off the you know, the proverbial pulpit, right? I think young people are struggling because they're tired of being seen as kids. It's the word kid is pejorative to them. And they want to be seen as human, as people. The other thing, though, is what it's always been. We expose them. You just expose them to as much as possible. You continue to show them things that they don't think they'd like and figure out creative ways to convince them that they do. I'll leave it here. But I love when a young person tells me that they hate Shakespeare. Because I remember being a kid who hated Shakespeare, right?
Yeah.
Shakespeare is taught awfully in high school.
I've been there.
Awfully.
I've also been there.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
But then you tell a kid, okay, well, what's your favorite TV show? Oh, man, I love Power. I love this, that, and the third, right? And it's like, well, then you love Shakespeare. Turns out you love it. Right, because Power ain't nothing but it's a Shakespearean play. If I ever seen one, almost every love story that they know is Shakespearean. All of their dramas, all their video games, most of them are Shakespearean. So it's really about helping them understand, sort of like taking this thing that feels so outdated and connecting it to something that they already know, and then working backward. And what you'll get is kids who feel valued, and it's funny because they get to sort of talk their talk, right? And you get kids who are comprehending the work and understanding that actually it is for them and it is about them. And we strap information to them and send them out into the world instead of telling them, no, you are the information. You exist within the information. You are part of the information. And I think that keeps kids a little more sparked, you know?
Oh, amazing. I'm so glad that young people have your work, have you at the helm, and have somebody that believes in them, writing amazing books for them. Jason, thank you so much for joining me and talking about your work and your life and your inspirations. This was an absolute pleasure, and I am so glad that we got to have you on the show.
My pleasure. I appreciate it. Thank you so, so, so much.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of At Liberty, please subscribe and rate and review the show. We really appreciate the feedback. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU, produced by me, Vanessa Handy, and Kendall Seesmeyer. This episode was edited by the folks at Ultraviolet Audio.